Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Good morning. Welcome to Investing Simplified. And I'm your host, Chuck Price. I'm not sure the sound is on right, but I think we'll eventually get it.
I think we're there.
You think we're there? Okay. Well, welcome to Investing Simplified. This morning is going to be a great show. I've got in the studio with me Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning, Carl. And Kevin Stege with the Baker Colson CPA Firm.
Good morning, gentlemen.
And we've got a special guest on the air that comes every other month, and Rodney Johnson with the who's co-editor of Economy Markets, Economy and Markets Daily, which is a daily email you can get, newsletter. And you can sign up for that at harrydent.com, or you can also get it on my website at pfgwm.com. And Rodney, are you there?
Yes, I am, Chuck.
Okay. Well, we had a little snafu there. I couldn't tell for sure if we were on the air or not. But anyway, hey, I hope I'm sure your weather in Tampa is as beautiful as ours is in Portland.
Well, it might be a little muggier and a little hotter down here, but we do have sunshine.
Well, that is a plus.
Yep. That's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, Rodney, I know you guys are gearing up for your Irrational Summit coming in October, and I do want to encourage people that can go on our website and connect to your website. People can still sign up for that and attend that. You still have some opening spots for that. I unfortunately can't go this October, but I'm really excited about next year because Harry said it's going to be in Vancouver, B.C., so I'm real excited about that.
It's a long way to go, but it is in October in Miami. And so, you know, people from rainy parts of the country that we won't mention might want to go to a sunny spot in October. So just saying.
Yeah, just saying. I mean, if you're in the Northwest and it's raining like crazy and it's blistery, a week in Miami might not be bad.
Exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, a lot of things going on in the economy. One of the things that we talk about on our show on a regular basis, and I noticed you guys did mention it on Harry mentioned it on his network notice that he sends out here. But one of the concerns I have is what's happening to the 10-year Treasury rate, how that thing is sinking into the sunset, and the fact of what the rates are around the world. I mean, Germany's almost disappeared.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring that up because it's something that I've written on a couple of times, and I write so much sometimes I forget where it gets published. But there's this notion that as the Federal Reserve stops printing money to buy Treasury bonds to keep rates lower, which, of course, they've been tapering off now for, 7-8 months, that interest rates have to go up because this buyer is walking out of the market. Well, that part is true if everything else was held constant. But, of course, the world is an ever-changing place. And so treasuries actually benefit as people kind of worry about the economy. They maybe worry about geopolitical events, this and that. And so people go buy treasuries as a kind of a parking spot, which brings the yields down. But there's also this notion of looking for the best yield around the planet, which is, of course, you know, something you bring up there. We look at the 10-year U.S. Treasury bond and say, well, what's the yield? And today, or actually at the end of yesterday, I believe it was 2.36%, which sounds terrible, of course, almost 2.5% for 10 years. But as you noted, you look at Germany, it's right about 1%. I mean, 1.02. That's for 10 stupid years. And you know, you look at certainly Switzerland and a couple of other good credits, and they're around 1.5%. You get into the bad credits. I mean, who would lend money to Italy? Who would lend money to Spain? These people are still getting 3-3.5% on their 10-year government bonds, which seems crazy. But it means that there's a lot of money looking for a home, and they believe at the end of the day, governments will eventually make good, of course, barring Argentina. And so we, as the United States, kind of look like the high-yield offering. It's very strange. But at 2.35%, 2.4%, we're much higher than Germany by quite a bit.
Yeah, I don't know anybody that wants to tie their money up for 10 years, even at 2.35%. It's still a pretty low rate. And although I think foreign countries, you know, as we've discussed with you guys before, when things get bad, they will come to America and they will put their money here where they may not leave it in their own country.
They might not. And an interesting thing about European countries, those that share the euro with the 18 countries that use the euro, they've got an issue right now because in the United States, our central bank, the Federal Reserve, will pay a bank 25 basis points, 50 basis points in terms of interest on the excess reserves that they hold at the bank, which means a bank may have extra money that they could lend out. They just don't find enough good borrowers, and so they have this extra cash. They get a little bit of interest on that from the Federal Reserve. In the Eurozone, the European Central Bank recently told all the banks, if you hold your excess money with us, we're going to charge you 10 basis points. We're not going to pay you interest. We're actually going to charge you to keep it here. And so that penalty rate was meant to kind of force the banks inside the Eurozone to go look for borrowers, try and get the money out the door to stimulate economies throughout the Eurozone with Germany and France and Spain and Italy and Greece and Portugal and stuff. But it didn't work because the banks didn't find any better borrowers the second day than they had the first day. And so it makes sense that a lot of these banks that might have been keeping their excess reserves at the European Central Bank are now going, well, I have this pot of money. I don't want to lose money by putting it at the European Central Bank. I'll instead take it and go buy government bonds. And so they buy German bonds. Maybe they also buy some United States bonds that have to change it into dollars, but it looks like a pretty safe bet, and you're getting twice the interest rate. So I think there's a lot of things going on in the banking sector where governments are desperately trying to force banks to make loans, which on the other side is forcing borrowers to take them, and it just doesn't work. It's pushing on a rope.
Well, you know, we always joke about that if you put your money in the bank at 20 basis points after taxes and inflation, you're not actually making any money at the bank. Your savings is really losing money. So,
oh, absolutely.
I guess maybe we still have it better than some of those places in Europe. No doubt about it. You know, one of the other things I noticed in the Dent newsletter too that he talked about, that Chinese lending dropped 75% last month. Property sale volume was off 17.8%. Total amount of social financing dropped from nearly a 2 trillion won in June to 273 billion won in July.
And that's a really interesting point you bring up, Chuck, because the Chinese economy has been growing for many years. Since the mid-80s, it's been growing at double digits. Now, to keep an economy growing at 10% or greater for 20 years is, of course, phenomenal. Well, there was no personal property rights, you know, under the old regime, the communist regime. Then property rates came in the early 80s, and it's kind of been loosening as you go along, so people can actually own an apartment, they can own a piece of land. And, of course, as you're selling off that land, people have a place that they can invest in a home. And they don't use the stock market like we do. They're much more interested in property. Well, as they made more money, they sold more exports to people like us, they had more cash coming in, they bought more property, and it became this growing cycle, a lot like our housing bubble was, but stretched over a longer period of time. Well, now they're starting to see some cracks in that. The property values are not going up like they did. As a matter of fact, their own statistical agency showed that the property values in the 100 cities they track started to go down a little bit. Well, that's a huge deal, because when you put all of your wealth into an apartment and then a second apartment and it starts to go down, of course, you're upset that you're losing money. It means the next guy who might invest steps away, because why in the world would he catch the falling knife? And so this was a big concern that the property market was no longer going up, but it actually turned to go down. And when we saw that property sales volume, which you mentioned, had dropped by almost 18% in a month, that means buyers are stepping away in droves and going, I'm not interested right now. I'm going to wait for prices to fall. That's what the Chinese government is very worried about, because the property market, if you add in all the ancillary businesses, concrete, steel, and timber, and everything that goes into building, 20% of their GDP, a full one-fifth, is tied up in building. And so if that starts to drop off dramatically, which it looks like it might have started, then they're going to see their GDP fall. They're on track right now to have the lowest GDP growth since 1989. Nobody's more concerned about that than the Chinese government.
Yeah, what's going to happen to their roaring stock market?
Well, yeah, that's a very good question. And better is what's going to happen to all of the things that they bought. Because it's never just one economy, right? The Chinese import a tremendous amount of natural resources. They import a lot of steel, although they now make a lot. They import a lot of coal. They import many, many things. And so the people that are supplying them, Latin American countries, certainly Australia being so close with a lot of iron and different ores, they're all the big suppliers that have made a ton of money off of the growth of China. Well, as China slows down, they're not importing, and this kind of becomes a domino effect that goes backwards, and it goes up the supply chain and becomes a dramatic negative effect to all of these countries that are supplying China, which is one reason we've been very, very cautious about emerging markets for really the past 6 months, because we've seen this backup growing, and we don't want people standing in the way when it kind of comes to them and knocks them over.
Kevin, you...
Yes.
Are you not on?
I can't hear Kevin,
okay.
So he's talking.
Yeah. I got your speaker on, though, but okay. Anyway, Carl?
Well, yeah. Well, Rodney, well, while we're getting a cup of coffee for Kevin, I was thinking that the China situation with the real estate has really been, you know, folks have been talking about it for a long, long time. But now I've even heard some, you know, some regular, normal, large news type agencies doing stories on it. And you're going, huh, if they're doing stories on it, it's really must be getting to a crisis point, you would think. So it sounds like maybe they're getting to the point where, and I understand they have lots and lots of buildings, like huge buildings with apartments and things like that in various cities that are just empty, that are just sitting there.
Well, actually, they have entire cities that are empty. There are several cities that could hold more than 1 million occupants that have no one living in them. And in the United States, that just sounds like the craziest thing you've ever heard of, right? Why would you build a ghost city? Typically, cities grow around a natural resource or a point of trade, and then when that falls away, you know, the ghost towns out west where there was mining for silver and gold in the 1840s and 50s, and then when nothing was found or it was exploited, they all left. China's got a different view of it, and so we've got a little caution around that because part of it, the deal is the Chinese bring workers from rural areas to cities to build industry. And so if they have a port town, they have a manufacturing town, they may see a future need for 1 million people to help support whatever the industry is, and they'll build all the housing and everything for it ahead of time, and then, of course, people move in and they buy and they start populating the city. The problem is, if you build this and then you don't need it, what happens? You just have millions of vacant apartments and different buildings that start to deteriorate. That's the situation they're in. They built these ghost cities that they could really kind of do plug and play with people, which is a weird notion here in the West. But now they don't have the business activity to support it because, of course, their clients, being us in the United States and the countries of the Eurozone, the economic bloc, we slowed down, and so we're not buying as much. Well, they don't have to export as much, so they don't need to build as much. So all of a sudden, these ghost towns just sit.
I have a great use for those giants, you know, those giant cities that are just empty. I think that would make a wonderful set for the next mega zombie movie.
You know, it's funny you say that because I would think Hollywood would jump on that. They could go in and shoot all kinds of movies in there, and nobody's in the city to mess up the movie.
You know, and here I'm going to throw some cold water on this conversation, Jeff. The reason that film companies don't go overseas like that is because we, as American cities and states, give them tax breaks to come to our location. So why would you pay to go to China when states like Michigan will actually pay you to show up and do work there? Isn't that a great use of tax dollars?
Well,
paying
maybe,
movie companies
maybe that's why
film?
Michigan's broke. They're bankrupt. Well, you know, I think what happened was they watched the Field of Dreams, and they said if you build it, they will come.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it did work for a long time. So, you know, there was method in their madness, but as with many things, you can jump the shark, you know, from the old Happy Days thing where you kind of go beyond, and that's exactly where they are.
Well, you know, one of the concerns I have in looking at the overall economic situation in the world, not just in America. I mean, ours is not a real positive situation either. But looking at the rest of Europe and stuff, it's kind of weirdly kind of boiling up to like a pre-World War II, where at that time inflation was rapid. The old joke about, you know, in Germany they had to go get your paycheck in a wheelbarrow and the money was mounting up and everything. And the world was kind of at crisis, economic crisis. One of the concerns I have here, you know, with what Russia's doing right now, if we have an economic, if we have a war that breaks out, what's that going to do to the economics?
Well, and that's an interesting question. You know, if we had an all-out war, then it leads to inflation, usually, because you're plowing a lot of money into an area of the economy that doesn't lead to a grower standard of living. So, you know, food is the easiest example. You know, you take a million combatants that you would send overseas and you have to feed them. And so you're taking away from your food stock here at home to kind of send it over there. And so that becomes a big drain on your economy, and it leads to a shortage of resources locally because, of course, you're sending them somewhere else. And you have to fund all that. And so not only do you have a lack of the resource at home, but you're having to pay a lot of extra money for something else. So the interesting question, though, is newer wars, I guess if you can think of it, more recent conflicts, involve a lot of technology and not as many people. And so, unfortunately, what we've done is we've created a situation where the combat doesn't take as much in terms of people, but it displaces a tremendous number of people in terms of refugees that you then have to support with the same logistics that you needed for the combatants. So it's crazy.
Well, I'm sharing Carl's microphone here now, so...
we don't want to know about that.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, and that's dovetails with the question that I had. I have to admit, I'm not... I've read the books on demographics in the past, but I'm not fully brushed up on all of the facts on them here. But I'm wondering if, you know, I've been spending my time in the dark recesses of the Affordable Care Act, so that's that's where I've been. But it seems like maybe is it going to take like a world event to maybe kick this downturn in, or is it going to be, or is demographics alone going to be enough to, is it going to be a, you know, just a big event, or would demographics be more of just a gradual downturn over the course of some time?
Well, demographics are, as we say, a broadsword. It's not a scalpel, you know, and so it creates and then removes a wave of people doing something. And so demographics are never the trigger. As they say, you know, you got grains of sand, grains of sand, grains of sand that you're piling on top. You don't know which grain of sand is going to make it cascade down a side. And so we don't look at this and say, well, it has to be on this day because there are going to be X number of consumers who are going to remove their power from the market by not buying as much. We say that there's going to be a downtrend in the number of people participating in a part of the economy. Fewer people buying second homes. And I don't mean second, meaning they now have two. I mean trading up. That's where we are, because the Generation X, which came after the boomers, are not buying homes at the same rate that the boomers bought in the late 90s and the early 2000s. There's just fewer of them. So clearly, that market's going to take a hit. And that's what happened. This is going on around the world in developed nations. Certainly Japan is leading the way. They've been in a downtrend for demographics for over 20 years. Germany's got this going on. France has it going on. Italy has it in spades. And so what you're seeing is this deflationary funk kind of falling over these different places where there's not enough consumer demand being pushed through a system to actually build these different economies. So everybody tries to go to exports. Everybody wants to export. Well, eventually you can't export to everybody because somebody's got to be importing. Somebody's got to be paying the cost. And that's where we're struggling right now. The nations that are growing, which would tend to be the Asian nations, the Asian tigers, they have younger populations that would demand more. They just don't have the economic power yet to be buying all the things we would export. And so we're in this weird impasse where we're slowing down. When I say we, I mean the Western developed nations, but the younger nations aren't nearly strong enough to pick up that demand yet.
Well, you know, when I listen to all the economic news, you know, the unemployment numbers and everything else, the thing that really concerns me from a standpoint of financial planning and working with my clients, as most of my clients have all already made their wealth. They're now right. living off their wealth, and they're now living off their income. And they're going to pass this to their kids. But the younger generation, their incomes are lower. There's less of them working. And there doesn't seem to be a system in America where we're developing jobs that are higher-paying jobs. You know, you got... I know the numbers that came out that said that 5 years ago, the average family is making something like $1,200 to $1,500 less than they're making today. I mean, how does that grow the economy?
That's a very good question, Chuck. We're in a period here where the boomers are saving, and it doesn't mean they live badly and don't spend. They're certainly spending money and have a nice lifestyle, but they're not going out and doing leveraged borrowing. They're not buying homes with, you know, a big mortgage. They're not buying $50,000 cars, you know, with zero down, that sort of thing. They've already got their stuff. They still have a nice lifestyle, but they got their stuff. And there just aren't enough people doing that sort of borrowing and spending to grow the economy from where it was. And we're going to have to get through this trough, and the only thing that does it is time. The real question is, how far down do we fall with that younger generation not having the economic power to buy things and really grow their life? I mean, you want to get married, you want to have children, you want to kind of move on down the road of life. But if you're not making enough money, how do you feel the security to go do that? And we're seeing those life positions being pushed off some, not getting married as they were, not buying the first home, certainly not having kids as they were before. And so that pushes our economic recovery further and further out. And so from our standpoint, looking at demographics, we're wondering how far they have to fall before we start that liftoff again. And unfortunately, it's probably another 5-6 years. I mean, it tends to go about a decade, maybe a little bit longer in these downturns before we really get the rebound to set in.
Well, you know, I still see a lot of young people out there who, like you say, they're aspiring to go to school. They're aspiring to do better. They want to go into business. They want to buy a house. They want to get married. They want to have families. They want to be successful like they've seen their parents and their grandparents do. But the opportunity for them is just not there. And I think somehow we've got to, as a society, kick this thing in the pants and get it moving in another direction, because the way we're going right now, we're going to have a generation who's never had an opportunity to go out there and really build their net worth, and they're going to pass on. The baby boomers are going to pass it on to their kids, and unfortunately, it's kind of like the guy that signs the NBA contract. And the sad news of a pro athlete is they make all this money, and at the end of the day, when they retire, they end up with very little.
Yep, and you know, you make a change in the nation to do that. There are certainly some ways that. You know, that I think, and I know you share some of these views on how we could allow business to grow in a much better, unfettered way, right? You simplify Yep. the tax code, change some of the things about repatriating of dollars and these things. But at the end of the day, while that will help some, the overall theme here in the United States, as well as in Germany, is slack demand. And it's just there. Right? We have slack demand because we're not buying at the same rate that we did before. And so we're not making the claim on business we did before. So they don't have the need to hire as many people. They may be more efficient if you get rid of some of the rules and change some of the things, but it would be hard to see how our unemployment rate would drop from 6.3 down to 4%, or we would bring those millions of people who stepped out of the workforce back in because we just don't need them right now. And so what do you do? How do you change the situation to bring those people back into the workforce without a very large public works project? And that, of course, is a huge other thing.
Well, Rodney, there's one thought that crosses my mind in all of this, and I'm in agreement with Chuck because I know my kids are fairly young, and even with good educations, it's very hard for them to find jobs that are truly living wages, and so the thing that kind of crossed my mind was though, a lot of people would love to have their own business, but unfortunately. As those of us who are self-employed know, it's extremely costly to have a business, not only by way of the fees that we have to pay for, government licensing and the variety of other things, but also the tax burden is much higher on a self-employed person. It just strikes me that the tax code is one place that you could encourage a lot of these people who maybe have good educations or give them a little better opportunity to be able to keep some of the money that they make, because it's really frustrating, I know, for people to work for themselves and they bring in some significant money. I have a lot of people that do like contracting work, and I'm sure Kevin sees this in his practice where you'll have somebody who goes out and starts a business and starts doing really well, and then they get into really trouble because they really don't realize how much they're going to have to pay, and so they don't do their quarterly estimates very well, and they can't believe it, and then they it kind of discourages them, and a lot of times puts them out of business because they start taking a little bit from the employees and a lot of other things that result in business failures a lot of times. So it seems to me that the tax code could be used in that sense to bring on more and more small businesses, providing that unique services and maybe develop a greater sense of entrepreneurship.
I think you're right. I mean, it's always been the problem. We're a small business, and of course have been for almost 20 years now. And one of the things that we struggle with is making sure that when you're in a new location, you've actually found all the tax authorities you have to deal with. I mean, it's one thing to pay the federal government. Everybody kind of knows that. It's another thing to pay the state. Kind of got a sense of that one, sales tax. But what about your city? What about their transportation tax, their local business development authority tax, and their transportation for city transportation? It's just bizarre, all the things you have to do. And you end up very quickly understanding you have to hire a sales tax and small business accountant that you never knew existed, and you didn't know you needed, and they're very expensive.
That's right in Kevin's bellywick, because that's one of the reasons we hired Kevin was we had all these things and we wanted to make sure we were paying our taxes correctly, and fortunately he knows how to do that in the local area, but you got to hire somebody who knows what they're doing.
Well, yep, absolutely.
And then the frustrating thing is when you do pay all of these and then you look at what government is spending the money on, that their revenues, that's the thing that gets you, guaranteed pensions. I mean, who gets a guaranteed rate of return anymore on a pension? And just so on and so forth. You just go down the line of what government is actually spending the money on. It adds to the fire.
That's a nice way to put it. It adds to the fire. Because who wants to pay more when you look at it and go, well, but I don't agree what you're spending it on. Yeah, if only those two things went together. You can have my money as long as I can direct how it's spent.
Well, I noticed one of the other comments here in Harry's little note that he puts out to the network members, and he talked about San Diego looks to derivatives to save their pension plan. Kind of goes right along with what we're talking about. Here's the thing that created all this big problem in the past. Now they're going to bail out their pension plan using derivatives.
Well, exactly. And San Diego is an example that we used in our book a few years ago as to how these public pensions got into trouble. And San Diego is kind of a poster child. And it was really politicians in the 90s who were trying to strike a deal with public worker unions, which, of course, is their job, but they're promising these benefits that are very expensive. And then, of course, 2 years later, the politician's gone. But the benefits are still there. And in California, once you have given them the benefits, this is being argued in court right now, but the general idea is you can't take them away. And so your choices are very limited. How do you do this? Well, you can say that they don't get them as soon. You can do that. So they have to work longer. You can say that they have to pay in more. That's possible. Or you can raise taxes to fund it from your constituents. None of those are fun choices. And so here with San Diego going, oh, I know, we'll use complex financial instruments to try and get better yield. And it's like, well, you're not the first guy to enter the market. So if there's better yield out there without risk, you're probably not going to be the one to find it. So chances are this will blow up in their face and they'll end up even further behind the eight ball than they are today.
You know, on the news, you know, 6 months ago, all we heard about was that Detroit was going broke, that California was broke. It was almost like California is going to break off and fall into the Pacific Ocean. And now we don't hear anything about that. Is just the news just covered it up, or did all this debt just go away, just magically disappear?
Well, interestingly, Detroit hasn't gone away. There's a very large fight in Detroit that is growing very quietly. And it's because in Detroit, they have an asset, which is their art institute. They have this art museum, a bunch of art. There's a question of what it's worth. It's been valued around $800 million, but, you know, arguably around $1 billion. And a group is getting together to say, well, we don't want this sold off in chunks and disbanded. As a unit, it's a great deal, and it's a great public deal. So different foundations have pledged money to buy it from the city and then leave it where it is intact. But they'll only do it if the money that they put toward it goes only to the retirees and future retirees of the city of Detroit. And so what's gone on is there have been a number of other people who have a claim on the city of Detroit. Right now, it's people who have insured their bonds, their municipal bonds that they sold, who say, wait a second, you can't direct money in a bankruptcy to just one creditor, which are the retirees and future retirees. Any asset that is held by the city has to be spread across all the people who are kind of the same type of creditor, the same general class. And they're not being treated the same. Well, retirees are going, no. We get more, see, because we're people. And the bondholders or the bond insurers are going, well, wait a second. Eventually, somewhere down the line, all of our bonds are held by people, too, like retirees in other parts of the country. And the fight, though, is to not argue too loudly until you get to court, because you don't want to be seen as the person who is clearly saying less money should go to retirees. But that is the argument. And this isn't a small argument. This is over really $500 million. Detroit is dead broke. They don't have the money. But the fight's going to be at the courthouse, and it really just started because this assignment of debts and values is just coming here in August.
You'll forgive me for having a gleam in my eye, and I'm trying to wonder what it's like to live in Detroit. But I you know, this is the stuff of which lawsuits are made. This could be a career.
Carl's getting excited here. Yeah.
So well, I understand.
For Detroit.
You know,
yeah.
The real estate prices are low in Detroit, I think. You know,
I understand that this is the stuff that lawsuits are made of, no question. This is where the law gets broken. The law was broken when General Motors went through bankruptcy and money was directed to one group instead of another. It was clearly broken. The people who were the short end of the stick, which were bondholders, sued. It went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, look, that bankruptcy as it was decided against the law is going to stand, but we're not going to allow this lawsuit to be precedent for any other lawsuit, which basically means we know it was wrong. We're going to let it happen anyway. We just say we're not going to let anybody else do it. As a prediction, I certainly have no crystal ball, I believe the bondholders in Detroit will lose because there is a judge who will say, no, the people, the retirees, they get more than anybody else because they're here on the county steps and the city steps. And you know what? They got homes, they got families, and they're retirees. So we're going to give them more, even though it flies in the face of the law.
You know, it didn't seem to work when the banks were under, though. I mean, you know, they didn't say, oh, gosh, look at those poor homeowners or all those, you know, folks out there that are going to get their houses foreclosed. They said, oh, poor banks, we'll just pay you off.
It's interesting that as banks pay these very large fines and they say the money goes to help homeowners, it doesn't really seem to. It seems to stay within the departments that are suing the banks. I'm looking for my check. You know, I pay my mortgage on time, kind of do what I'm supposed to do. Where's my check? I keep checking the mailbox. Maybe they sent it to the wrong address.
Well, it didn't come to mind, I can tell you that. Well, you know, hey, Rodney, we really appreciate your time. Looking forward to talking to you in a couple of, you know, I think we're going to be missing the October one because that's right when you guys are having your Rational Economic Summit.
That's true. That would be the exact same time. Yeah, so I will talk to you all again in December, I guess.
Absolutely. Well, listen, you have a great rest of the summer, and I hope we keep telling people on our show about the Irrational Summit to attend it. They can attend it. Anybody can attend it. You can go on my website or you can go to harrydent.hsdent.com and you get all the information there. You also sign up for Economic and Markets and Daily on my website, and it directs you also to the dent.com website. Rodney, appreciate your time, and we'll be talking to you again.
Thank you all. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. We're going to come right back, take a quick break, and come back with Carl Jepsen's comments on the law. And I think he might be packing his bags for Detroit, but we'll find out.
Price Financial Group.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com. Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepsen, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepsen.
Guns and money.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. It's always kind of hard to follow Rodney Johnson because he's got such a lot of good things to say, and he does it in, as Chuck says, an elegant way, and I think he does. It's really great. So anyway, Carl's comments, that's where I talk about something that's come up in my practice or reminded of in my practice in the week, and try to hopefully offer you some insight into the mind of lawyers. And of course, you may not want that. But anyway, at least into the way that things work and that sort of thing. But I also try to do some things that are practical. This is called 10 Steps to Putting Your Affairs in Order. And there are by no means the only steps necessarily, but I just thought these are useful for you. And so the first one is protect yourself from the greedy and unscrupulous. And what I mean by that is, unfortunately, there are a lot of incidences these days of financial elder abuse. And people will take advantage by all sorts of means and, you know, contrivances and lies and, you know, all sorts of things. And so there are some tools that you can use to avoid some of those kinds of things happening. One of is a good power of attorney with a person who is really trustworthy. That's number one, by the way, is to make sure that whoever you have doing things for you is truly trustworthy. And if you need to be very, very concerned about that. And sometimes it's the least expected person that will, you know, take advantage of you. So power of attorney is a good thing to have, but again, it's a bad thing to have if you give it to the wrong person. You should make sure that you nominate a guardian or conservator. whoever it is that you want, just in case you have a stroke or you get Alzheimer's or something that's terrible that happens to you and you no longer can make decisions and maybe you don't have these other things going on, then you really need to have that in place so that at least you have given your voice to a preference to the person that should be. And I would also say if you have someone that you absolutely do not want to be your guardian and conservator, put that in it too, because oftentimes it's the one that you want and the one that you don't want that fight for the privilege of, you know, controlling your money and maybe your life if they're going to be your guardian. So be careful with that. So protect yourself from the greedy and unscrupulous. Plan while you can. And number two, provide security for your family. In other words, provide for an orderly transfer of your property to people you want to have it. So this is giving what you want to whom you want when you want. And so we're talking about a will. We're talking about a trust. We're talking about joint property, joint ownership. And we're talking about beneficiary designations and transfer on death designations. These things assist in the quick and easy transfer of property in the event that you die. That's a good favor to your people. They usually work together. Most of my people have one or more of all of those things as we get through the process. So number three, preserve your story. And what I'm saying is here, preserve your biography some way, or preserve an obituary, or put together a letter to your heirs, or, you know, you can even, you never know, but those kinds of things are very important, and they may be the greatest gifts that you can possibly give, but they do take some time. So it might be useful to sit down and at least write your story so that someone will know or will be able to remember. And just a thought, doesn't cost you anything, and it doesn't, you know, but it may be, like I said, it may very well be the greatest gift that you can give to your heirs. Number four is kind of like that. Pass on your values and beliefs. And so what I'm talking here is something like that we call an ethical will, and I've done a show talking about ethical wills, which is essentially that. It's a document that you prepare that talks about the importance of various things, you know, whether it's a faith, whether it's ethics, whether it's, you know, honesty, integrity, or hard work, or whatever it is that you believe in. It's a very nice thing to do. And sometimes you could do it in the form of what we call a blessing. A blessing would be, you know, this is what I hope for you. This is what I hope for your parents. This is what I hope for your kids. This is what I hope for your, you know, pets, and that sort of thing. But whatever, it's a really good idea. So that's number four. Number five, make peace with as many of your family members as you can. You know, one of the things I see is that a lot of times the husband or wife who is the last to die seems to be the glue that held together the family. And when that person dies, then the family kind of loses its rudder and loses its restraint on social behavior. And all of a sudden they, you know, so I would say try to make peace with all of those people, and you probably know who they are, that you really don't get along with in your family. They'll be better for it. You'll be better for it. And everyone related to them will be better for it. Number six, help those less fortunate. Make charitable gifts during your life and with your estate planning. Number seven, minimize your loved one's stress. Well, here's what I'm saying really is make it easy for them. Prepare a good estate plan, and we've talked about some of the components of that. If you can, get prearranged burial and funeral plans, especially if you're in your retirement years. Those can be really, really helpful for those of us who've had to run around right after a catastrophic death or something and to figure out how to do funerals and how to do, you know, burial things. That's you know, it's just one of those things that's really challenging. And, you know, if you take a lot of the guesswork out of that for your loved ones, that's a good thing. Make sure that someone has instructions as to how you want to distribute your personal property. You know, the grandfather clock, the fishing gear, the fancy chair that you loved that you've had forever and ever and ever, those kinds of things, the collection of stamps and whatever. Make sure that those things are distributed properly. Most of my wills and trusts have what I call a personal property distribution provision, which says, you know, if my trustee finds a list of stuff with my papers, then they're supposed to honor that. And I would say let it be known that you've done that, because otherwise then you don't want to come up with competing lists somewhere. And then also, as part of minimizing stress, organize your information. Make sure that your papers are available to your loved ones. They know who your advisors are, your accountant, your financial advisor, your attorney. They should know where your keys are, like keys to safe deposit boxes and that kind of stuff. And finally, they should know all your electronic stuff. I mean, or know where it is. Passwords, logins, those kinds of things, because, boy, those can be difficult. The electronic property is, or the, what do they call it, virtual property is very, very difficult to track down, and getting through the firewall of the company that that has your stuff, if you don't know the answer, is oftentimes a really big chore. So those are some tips to minimize your loved one's stress. Number 8, have some adequate insurance that you have to talk to your insurance person with. Number 9, we've talked about this before, clean out your garage. Make sure that all that stuff is gone. Don't make your heirs do it. And then finally, if you got all that stuff done, say thank you to all of the honest, trustworthy, kind, hardworking, faithful, dependable, self-sacrificing people who made your life easier and simply doing by what's right. So that's Carl's comments for the week.
Wow, good comments. Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break and come right back with Kevin, the tax investigator. And if you've got a question or you got a call, you can reach us at 1-800-990-0750. You know, we never even said the numbers today. So give us a call if you have a question. Thank you very much, and we'll be right back.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over 3 decades, and its 9 attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask the tax investigator, Kevin Stege, CPA and partner of the Baker Colson CPA firm. You can call Kevin at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's the CPA with the tax answers, CPA Kevin Stege.
You are listening to Investing Simplified, and Carl has reluctantly given up his microphone to me so that I can have this segment. I think I might have ruined my microphone setting it up this morning, so we'll see how that plays out. But good words of wisdom there, Carl. It brings to mind the old prophet saying, "Put your affairs in order for you shall surely die." And I guess that we just don't know when that will happen, but it's going to happen to all of us sometime. And so it's a good thing to do.
Die?
Yeah.
I know.
But you know, just taking a day, just set one day aside to do most of the stuff you had on your list, you can almost do in a day, other than maybe drawing up some of the documents and stuff. But a lot of this, if you just focus for a day, you can
the hard part is the first thing you have to do in doing that is face your mortality. And that's the problem. And that is a big problem that's one of the reasons why Carl and I, our business is really all about getting people to stop procrastinating and delaying doing those things. And that's the hard part, because human nature says you're going to live forever.
But that's right.
Really, that isn't going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, today on the Tax Investigator, I think I will continue with what Rodney had mentioned about all of the little taxes that jump out and grab you that you're not totally aware of. Maybe some of our listeners saw that Intel negotiated a 30-year extension on their favorable property tax rules. And I wanted to go in a little bit on the details on what they did, and it may surprise you what actually is happening here. At first blush, you're thinking, boy, why does the big corporation get such a tax break? Well, it actually isn't, in my opinion, that big of a tax break, and it's not on the taxes that you would think. You hear the term property taxes. Well, you're thinking value of land and building, just like we all pay on our residences, so on and so forth. That's not the property taxes that they're negotiated a tax break on. This is personal property taxes, and you may not know that all personal property in Oregon is subject to personal property taxes. There happens to be a few exemptions and exceptions, which includes non-business use personal property, but you know, your bed at home, your dresser, your desk, all those things are technically subject to personal property taxes, but because they are used in a personal manner, they are part of one of the exemptions. So basically, we're down to business property. The Intel deal basically says they pay full. They're going to pay their full fair share on all of their real property taxes, which is building and land value. That's not in question. What they did negotiate was the personal property tax break, because they want to put literally billions of dollars of industrial and other equipment, and actually they fall under one that's probably not personal property. It's probably industrial property tax, a different form that only the big boys tend to fill out. So, and so what they've negotiated is basically a reduction in that, because they want to bring literally billions of dollars of equipment into their new buildings. And getting a tax break of about $120 million a year over 30 years to bring in this billions of dollars to continue to grow Oregon, continue to show Oregon as a favorable place to do business, it seems like a pretty good deal to me. I'd hate to see Intel relocate due to and they're paying a lot of taxes anyway as it is in regards to other property taxes.
Yeah, so. I don't have a problem with that, as long as the long range plan is to increase employment in the state. I think it's a good investment for the state, the city, the county, and everybody combined. If we can bring more high paying jobs into the area, that's what we need to do.
Yeah.
And you know, companies like Nike and companies like Intel are companies that have been growing in Oregon, and you got to keep them here. I mean, you got to keep them here, no question about it.
And these are high-end jobs, engineers, sales managers, at a very technical level, and these are the jobs that we want to see in Oregon, and I think it's a good move, in my opinion.
Yeah, I do too. I you know, we always joke about, you know, giving tax breaks to companies and stuff, and encouraging people to come to certain areas of town. But if the state doesn't promote business growth, they're not going to have any. It's just that simple.
Yeah, there's other. Well, and we've seen it on the national level where companies are hopping overseas to save some taxes, you know, headquartering themselves overseas. It's going to happen because the tax burden is heavy and it's significant.
Well, so just look at what happened last year and the year before. All these companies moved out of New York, and a lot of them went down to Florida. And all of a sudden, what did New York do? They developed a tax-free zone to encourage people to come in there. And for 10 years, they give you a tax-free zone. Well, they realize they can't go out and blast all the businesses, and then pretty soon there are none in your state. And where are the jobs? They're going to Florida. So, yeah, I think it's important that states realize they got to promote growth within the state.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, on a last news item before we, looks like we're getting to the end of our show here, I noticed a court decision that came down, which always gets us excited, and this is in the estate tax area. A son who received who had a one-third interest in his mother's estate, he had a large tax bill to the IRS, about $500,000 that he owed the IRS. Well, he didn't want the IRS to get most of his mother's estate to pay for this tax bill, and so he ended up disclaiming his share of the estate to go back to his other, probably his other two siblings, and wanted to avoid the IRS putting a lien on his share of the estate. Well, it went through the courts, and the court said, no, you actually, for even if it's for a brief second or a day or 2 days or a week, you had right to that property. And we can still put a lien on your share of the estate. And so that's another wrinkle to consider in your estate planning and looking at your beneficiaries that, you know, if they have judgments against them, it's probably something worth considering.
Well, absolutely, and I'm not surprised by that decision, to tell you the truth, but because that works. Like, for example, some people try to avoid having to pay the parents' Medicaid expenses by something of that sort, you know, disclaiming anything that comes in the estate. That doesn't work. That the disclaimer just doesn't do it. And the reason for it is really quite simple. A disclaimer is just saying, I don't want it. But the problem is, you've already gotten the right to it. So if you've given it to them as an outright gift, or give them that kind of control over it, then it's vulnerable to those kinds of things. So a lot of times people, where they're worried about that sort of thing, will establish an irrevocable trust in advance that is the person they're trying to protect, it's never their money, and they put it in the trust, and it's totally we call it a credit spendthrift trust, and most of those work. I can't say that they're totally going to work all the time, but that way this person never ever gets control of the money, never ever has a decision that they get to make as to whether or not they get the money. And now that requires obviously like an independent trustee and that sort of thing. So, but good thing.
Absolutely. Well, I think that brings us to the end.
Okay. Well, how does somebody get a hold of you, Kevin?
That's right. We're at bakercolson.com, 503-666-5569. And you can email me at kstege, which is K-S-T-E-E-G-E, at baker-colson.com.
And Carl?
Warren Allen is at 503-255-8795, and we're at warrenallen.com on the web.
And Price Financial Group Wealth Management can be found at pfgwm.com on the web. And by the way, I'm redoing my website, and we still don't quite have up the radio inventory on there where you can go on and listen to our past radio shows, but we are working on it and hoping this next week we'll have it up. And we're also conveniently located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, right off the 205. 503-253-3000 or 877-50-PRICE. Have a great week. We're going to be back next Saturday. Don't forget to call us, set your clock, listen to our show in the morning with your morning cup of coffee, and give us a call. Thank you very much.